Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru.
And welcome to our next episode, Chapter 2, Part 2. How exciting. Today I am joined with the lovely Mike and Chris.
Hello.
Hey.
Glad to be here.
Priyank is not with us today. He is in India, I call the motherland. He is traveling, mm-hmm. So I'm sure he's with us in spirit, but not in physical form. So we have a really interesting episode, actually, about Paramahansa Yogananda and his dream of running away and what happens with that. So we'll jump straight on in and get started. So it begins this section with him recounting his cousin coming back from a sort of spiritual travel, a holy travel, and him recounting the stories of the yogis and the swamis. And how he listened with such eagerness at these tales, which I think says quite a lot about Yogananda at that young age. You know, the fact that he was so present with these tales and he wanted to hear them. I do wonder if that was an inclination, again, that he was meant to be of that path. But yeah, Chris, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I can't help it in this black and white world reality that we live in, compare and contrast myself, my own little story with Yogananda's. And just as you say, you know, Yogananda obviously went on to be a yogi himself and obviously very very well accomplished. So he was drawing this energy toward him, and his surroundings were well chosen by him. And my life was a little bit different, and I wish I had have had some cousins and some relatives who were doing these kind of things. But in Northern Ireland, I don't think you'd get too far in a robe and traveling the mountains that way. It's a lot too far to go. They were more influencing me to go dirt biking and things like this, unfortunately, which was a lot more dangerous. But no, it's an awesome. It is an awesome environment to be in, is it not? And he's got such an amazing family. And I would love to hear actually more about these tales, because he just drops it in about how eagerly awaiting these tales he was. But I myself am sitting here thinking, share with us the stories. I want to hear the stories as well. Just like Yogananda, I'm eagerly awaiting to hear more, but maybe it's in another book somewhere. If anybody knows of anything, please do let us know, because we will research this for sure. But I didn't see any.
It would be a very interesting book, wouldn't it? I would actually love to read that, of the little moments that made up his life with these stories. But I realized as I was reading this chapter again, I thought, you know, we talked about the word yogi a lot, but for some people, they might not know what a yogi is. And I know when I first read it, I didn't know. And much like the word we just said, I eagerly wanted to know what it was. And I realized that we don't actually find out what a yogi is until way on in the book, chapter 24, actually, in page 250 to 251. So I thought it would be nice to sort of give a general overview and a quote from the book about what is a yogi, in case any of us are wondering or we need a little refresh. I know Mike, Chris and myself were having quite a discussion before this podcast came on about, well, what's a yogi, what's a swami? So we're going to clarify the air here. Mike, would you like to tell us what is a yogi according to Paramahansa Yogananda in the autobiography of a yogi?
Yeah. Also, one of the points that we were discussing is, does one mean the other? So if you are a swami, do you have to be a yogi? And apparently that is not the case. I was surprised about that, but we'll hear about this in a bit. So Guruji says, a yogi is anyone who practices a scientific technique for divine realization is a yogi. He may be either married or unmarried, either a man of worldly responsibilities or one of formal religious ties. A yogi engages himself in a definite step-by-step procedure by which the body and mind are disciplined and the soul gradually liberated.
So by this definition, mm-hmm. we're all yogis. I take it.
It's strange, isn't it? You almost don't want, if you are practicing these techniques, you almost don't want to place that title on yourself. It feels quite grand, doesn't it, to say that. But, you know, according to this, if you are practicing techniques for realization, you are a yogi, which is, you know, interesting.
Devotee, I'm more comfortable with, right now. A student, a student of yoga.
Yeah, is
something I would refer to myself in the cold light of day, for sure.
It also comes to show that how meaningful the techniques are that Guruji is teaching. So when we practice them according to him, then we can say of ourselves that we are yogis and practicing yogic techniques, and he does say that in many places, but it's also something we need to make true to for ourselves, is that when we practice those techniques regularly, we do gradually liberate our souls.
So we have the Hong Sao technique and the Om technique, as well as the energization exercises. And all these are taught in the lessons that we're privileged to even be aware of. So these, by definition, would be scientific techniques, because it doesn't specify, or this isn't specified here in this definition. It says, practices a scientific technique for divine realization. Now, Yogananda talks in that language, so the science of yoga, we're a bit more familiar with that. So I wondered if that would apply to those those techniques in the early lessons, or would it be the more advanced technique of Kriya Yoga itself? I'm going to say it's both, but I'd be keen to hear what you guys have to say.
I think so too. Yogananda does call Hong Sao the baby Kriya often. So I'm guessing while Kriya is probably something that will get you there faster, Hong Sao will get you there as well, I'm guessing.
I wonder also if it's the intention behind the practice. You know, if you are practicing just for the enjoyment of practicing, you know, that's your choice. But it says here, practicing a scientific technique for divine realization. So I guess it's that intention. Am I doing this to be with God in union? Am I doing this for realization? I agree with both of you. For me, it feels like both. And you know, there are probably other scientific techniques that are not in our current sphere of awareness that can bring you that. And you know, I guess each has their own path, and that will take you where you need to go.
Mm-hmm. I think the Hong Sao technique, when I first did it, I felt, wow, like this just blew my mind. It was so great to have a technique. And I think it's something that we are very privileged to have, is a technique that really works, that, you know, that's given to us through well-practiced yogis that know exactly what they're doing. And I think it was Sri Dayamata was saying, if I'm not, I'm trying to look for the quote here actually, but she was saying how strong and how powerful that technique is, and don't misunderestimate it. And you know, you could sit with that and just do that and become realized, you know, if you really committed yourself to it. So I think you're right, it's a very powerful technique, and I like the idea of it being a mini or baby kind of version of a Kriya practice.
I also find it quite important that he doesn't go into depth about what the scientific techniques are. I feel like maybe that's a little nudge for any true spiritual aspirant or seeker to go and find out how you can learn these. So it's quite interesting. But yeah, so we know now what a yogi is, but what's a swami? Because as you said, a lot of us think they are the same, but as Mike said, they are not. So Chris, would you like to tell us what a swami is? And before you do, there is a footnote actually in the autobiography of a yogi, which says, after the word swami, it says, Sanskrit root for swami is, in quotes, he who is one with his self, swa.
So his goal is absolute union with spirit, imbuing his waking and sleeping consciousness with the thought, I am he. He roams contentedly in the world, but not of it. Thus only may he justify his title of Swami, one who seeks to achieve union with the Swa or self. Very good. So the question there then is, what is the difference between
what
the two?
What is the difference? Well, he goes on, as with all things, I find Guruji provides the answer to the questions our hearts are asking. And he says, a Swami may conceivably follow only the path of dry reasoning, of cold renunciation, but a yogi engages himself in a definite step-by-step procedure by which the body and mind are disciplined and the soul gradually liberated. So does that clarify things for you? Do you feel, Chris?
I don't know, actually, if it does, because we were talking before we jumped on this call that what did we really think off the top of our heads? My impression was simply that yogis, you know, were ones who practiced the yoga, and is defined here as the scientific techniques in the autobiography of a yogi. So I understand that to a degree, even though it does seem like a really grand title, and I certainly wouldn't be willing to call myself a yogi anytime soon, even though I do practice the techniques. But then a Swami, my impression then simply was that that's a formal title. So you would join, you know, we know of the Swami Order and the Self-Realization Fellowship, and that is more of an ordained title that you would have to go through certain practices and certain rituals in a way to be able to qualify for those positions. That was my idea of what a Swami is. So that's my rookie take on it. Then of course you have a guru and you have other titles out there as well that we'll not go into right now, I guess, but that was my take.
Yeah, and a Swami is basically a monk, right? So a Swami is a renunciant. A Swami cannot get married. A Swami has outwardly, he wears an orange robe, and he's committed his life outwardly to God. And like we saw, he doesn't have to be a yogi. So it doesn't mean he has to use scientific techniques to liberate his soul. Like, he can also use other ways to be a Swami. But a yogi is someone who can either be a Swami, or he can also be someone who is working a normal job, having a family, but still does the techniques. And I would call myself a yogi. I mean, I wouldn't advertise it, but in this definition, I would feel like I'm one of the yogis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that does start to begin to make sense, right? And it's not common to ever see a Swami in the UK, for example. You know, growing up in Northern Ireland, there's no people walking around in robes. But then but that does exist in India and other parts of the world, where you really do have those renunciants that live for spirituality and don't engage in the world of material. So it's a lot more common there, and would seem to, you know, as Mike, you give the definition there, makes sense. So if you're able to immerse yourself in the thought of I am he, as it's defined here, and roam contentedly, be in the world but not of it, yeah, that would make perfect sense.
We do have I mean, of all denominations, but in Europe we have a lot of Christian monasteries and monks, right? And they took an oath of celibacy, and they kind of, I'm not sure if a lot of them are yogis. Maybe some of them are. You don't really know. But I don't think that's primary what you expect of them. But they would live a life of study of the Christian traditions and maybe also teaching, and that's, I feel like that's kind of what you expect of Christian monks.
Mm, and probably
brewing,
other.
And in Germany also brewing beer, very important.
And probably other paths is probably similar, isn't it, Mike, as well? But a question that did actually come up for me while you two were speaking and I was listening is, and perhaps any of our listeners might know this, as I am what we call a rookie on the path, but I wonder if one is a Swami and has been practicing yogic techniques for divine realization, there may become a point in that soul's journey where they are completely liberated and at one with God, thus meaning the scientific techniques are perhaps no longer necessary in order to continue with that union with God. So therefore, the title of yogi perhaps wouldn't apply anymore, and they could just be Swami. Or I suppose in that state, titles don't even matter. And it's quite interesting, isn't it, actually, that I think we need these labels in order to understand what's going on, but in reality, really we are just souls on the journey, and the titles are just there for our little human minds to understand what it is and figure it all out. Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suppose it's important that whenever we've got this part in the autobiography of a yogi, that Yogananda is inspired by this, isn't he? Even as an avatar, he's talking about his inspiration and potentially recalling past lives, and it really does mean something, and it symbolizes this devotion and this great love that he and others would have for God and the work that they put in. So I think it really does have great meaning. And just to Mike's point there, you mentioned maybe more the Christian faith and the monks and things like this that we have in Europe. And it was in the autobiography of Yogi that we'll get to, but talked about St. Paul saying that I die daily as well. Mm-hmm. So Yogananda talked about that, when you die, that's, you're switching off the life current in the senses. And that's what he called being twice born. So yeah. There you go. There's a Swami in disguise, maybe, or in the Western world.
Yeah, he definitely was inclined, wasn't he, Chris? Yogananda, when he was listening to those stories as a child. Mm-hmm. Mike?
Guruji does say that Christ taught a technique that was similar to Kriya Yoga to his disciples. So I would definitely call St. Paul a yogi. So because I'm pretty sure he was on this path and might have been a liberated soul as well.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, going back to the book and the story. So he's heard these tales about these yogis and swamis, and as we've discussed this for quite some time. So obviously in us, we find it quite invigorating as well. So for him at that young age, it must have been utterly encapsulating. And he instantly said to son of the landlord, it says here, Dwarka Prasad, that may not be the correct pronunciation, but I gave it a go. And he said, let's run away to the Himalayas. And I feel like there's a sense of relatability here, because as children, we come up with these grand plans sometimes and we reveal them to other people and they fall on ears that aren't really sympathetic or in line with our own. And this is what happened to him. So he revealed his plan to this son, and this son went straight to his elder brother, Yogananda's elder brother, and told him about it. And as you can imagine, as a sibling hearing that, what you might respond to, Chris?
No, we know why, what happened after this happened, in that Yogananda's brother was very much aware of this possibility happening. And it just occurred to me, I wonder, because the thwarting of plans happened more than once to escape to the Himalayas. Were people like this, Dwarka Prasad, individual warned, say, hey, if you're going to have the talks about this, you need to come straight. You know, if Mukunda talks about this, you need to come straight to me and tell me. Maybe there's a reward in it for him or something. Because he did not think twice, did he? He went straight and told Mukunda, young Yogananda. So I just wondered if Yogananda's brother was, sneaky enough to try to get people to tell the tales on him.
I think they also saw Yogananda. He was like this little kid Mukunda, and they didn't really take his wishes that seriously. They were more like, okay, he's a little kid, and this is a bit of a, maybe it's a phase that he's going through, or he heard this from a friend, and they were just trying to be good parents as well. I don't think they really deviously were trying to stop him from finding God or something like that. I feel like they were more like, this is how it is in a family, right? Especially when you're very young, you don't just run away to the mountains.
And well, maybe, I don't know what it's like. It would have been good to have Priyank here. I don't know if he would have been able to give us any insight, but in India, with the spiritual heritage and the Himalayas being what they are, you know, it's a beacon of spirituality, essentially. I wonder if it is quite common for kids to see these swamis and see, you know, and look up to them and think, wow, you know, I could be, you know, roaming the world. And it's like an adventure in some ways, you know, it would be very attractive to many young children. So maybe this is more common than what I have been aware of growing up in Northern Ireland, that maybe Indian kids in certain parts of the world or in certain parts of India, maybe in Northern India, do want to, you know, go on that journey and escape. So maybe it's a bit more common. And it does actually, not, I say this out loud, maybe ring true, because the workers, you know, in the railways were able to kind of handle this with some ease whenever they, you know, captured Yogananda on more than one occasion. So maybe that is like a common occurrence. I don't know. I would love to hear more insight into that.
If any of our listeners or viewers have grown up in that area of the world, do let us know if that is common, because actually I had never really thought of it like that, Chris, but I suppose that does actually make sense. And it makes sense as to how his brother responds, the fact that he actually goes out of his way to ridicule little Mukunda and say, well, you know, where's your orange robe? You can't be a swami without that. And it's really, really poignant and important that from that mocking, from that ridicule, instead of little Mukunda feeling hurt and, you know, dismayed by this comment from his elder brother, he actually feels thrilled at the word. That this is a word he used. I was inexplicably thrilled. And he goes on to say that it brought him this clear picture of himself as a monk, you know, wandering around in the orange garb, and how he felt that he could wear that with great ease. And, you know, certainly reading it from hindsight, you can say, oh, yes, of course. But I suppose in that moment for him, it's again, it's that little soul call, isn't it? It's that, okay, well, yeah, this actually feels like the path for me. And yeah, I feel like it says a lot when we can be inspired by other people's ridiculing or negativity towards our feelings about our life. And I'm sure each one of us has had a moment where we've revealed something about our inner worlds and it's been ridiculed. And how do we really respond to that? And I think that says a lot about our character and where we're at.
Yeah, certainly. I think the cruelty of childhood is that there's much ridicule that takes place, and as part of being a child or a teenager, more so, you want to try to fit in, you know, you want to try to go along with the crowd, and you don't want to stick your head out too far, lest be chopped off by the crowd. And really, for this part of the story, we were talking just before we jumped on the call. It is interesting as to whether or not it was a clear picture as a bit of a vision, as we were talking about, or maybe he, you know, imagined it himself, the power of imagination versus a vision, this idea of hallucination versus a vision that we talked about in the last episode. But he was saying that it brought him a clear picture and of that himself as a monk in a previous life, roaming about India. So what do we think? Is it going to be controversial to say that he was imagining, or is it actually more likely that he was clearly seeing a past life at such a young age?
Yeah, I think it also shows that people like Ananta didn't really have a high respect for Swamis. That was definitely not one something that he wanted to do in his life. And also he didn't feel like anyone in his family should be aiming for that. It's not something that is regarded as like something that is like a high achievement. And when Guruji heard that, he thought the complete opposite. He was like, oh, orange robe, that sounds amazing. That's what I want. And he even visualizes himself. And of course, we know that later on, he will be Swami Yogananda, not so long from that point, maybe 10 years later.
Yeah, it's a curious point, because I was loosely making this in the last episode, in the last part, where we were talking about Yogananda's father's reaction to Yogananda's vision of his mother going to pass, and saying, hey, if you're going to want to see me before I go, you have to leave now. And Yogananda's father dismissed him and said, hey, that's a hallucination, I'm not going to pay attention to it. And a question to my mind was, there were so many miracles and things that happened in his early life, and the Lahiri Mahasaya, who was his father and his mother's guru, he gave a premonition, a heads up, your son's going to be, you know, a great soul that's going to bring many, many, many other souls toward God. So for me, I'm thinking to myself, wow, surely by now the whole family would have been backing him 110%. The reality is maybe somewhat different. And that does carry through until his late teens, early 20s. You know, he does go to university, he does stick to that path of somewhat being, getting an education in the Western sense. And he does go down that route. And we were saying maybe it was almost strange for Yogananda that he was out of the womb, you know, ready to be a yogi and his family. But it took him some years before he was maybe ordained and things like this. We thought maybe that would have happened a lot sooner. So he did actually get influenced by the people around him in this sense, and didn't just delve into that world, you know, immediately, because he was ready to do it from a young age, wasn't he? So he did pay attention, and he did listen, and he was influenced by those around him.
Mm. I actually feel quite comforted by that in a way, because, you know, if you think he was ready since birth, but he didn't initiate until Mike found out it was 1915. So how old would he have been? Was it 22, did you say? Yeah. Yes. So that's 22 years, right? So if you think when you started to realize that, you know, this was your journey, think 22 years from now, and it actually provides a lot of solace in where you are now in your own little path. So I actually found it quite comforting that he took that time. And I think he had to go through certain trials and life's leela, life's play, in order to help us on this path, but also get to where he needed to go.
And his father, Bhagavati, I think he was in his 40s by the time he was initiated into Kriya, and it was a rather abrupt initiation in some ways, wasn't it? That, you know, one day he was, you know, telling his worker, his employee, not to be bothered, you know, on this spiritual path, you know, focus on your career. That's what's going to get you ahead. To, you know, a day or two later, a few days later, being initiated by Lahiri Mahasaya himself into Kriya. So it was quite an abrupt, you know, shunt into that world. And obviously he was, you know, going to be a very enlightened individual, had been doing amazing sadhana himself for many years, for his whole life. But he himself was maybe later on in years before he was initiated into Kriya. as well, which is interesting. What is time?
Yeah, and I kind of think that Guruji being this young, he would already have joined the Swami order if they would have let him, right? So I feel like life tested him. Life put him, like, he had the brother who didn't let him escape. He had the father who said, please do high school and then also finish college. And then you're through with all of those things. And later on, Sri Yukteswar also tells him that you go to the West, and in the West, this is seen as like this is seen as something that makes you more believable. So that's part of it, why he probably has to do all those things.
Definitely. Yeah. And also, I'd like to jump back to what Chris asked a couple of conversations ago when he said, when you were asking, you know, when he said that he saw a clear picture of himself as wearing those robes, you know, was that imagination or was it actually a reality that he saw into? Priyank thought it was him seeing the future and his 1935 roaming through India, so a vision. I think, perhaps. But it's interesting also because Yogananda then goes on to say in the book, he says, perhaps they awaken memories of a past life. In any case, I realized, you know, he could wear it with natural ease. So it feels to me that perhaps even Yogananda wasn't sure if that was a vision or not. But in some ways, it didn't matter because he had a realization from that actually, you know, being a yogi, being a swami, wearing the garb was actually for him, which I think says more than if it's a vision or not, perhaps.
Yeah, it is interesting, the words that he uses here, and obviously it's very carefully crafted for us as well. So he says, perhaps they awaken memories, and then the next sentence is, the same sentence, apologies. It says, I realized with what natural ease I would wear the garb. So I realized, and that word realized, you know, has great significance to us, the realization. And then what brings us realization in this sense, you know, we could have been practicing for many, many lifetimes a certain thing, whether it be yoga or something else. And you may have certain realizations in this lifetime that might come pretty quickly, like crystal clear to you, and you might not know. And that's maybe why he says, perhaps they awaken memories, because it came so clearly, so vividly, so strongly to him that he realized this. So it's this realization, this memory coming back to him, which just goes to show, like, you have to put the work in. There's no, you know, there's no shortcuts to this, is there? You have to put the work in today so that, you know, if you can become realized in this life, that's fantastic. But if you don't, you know, you've still got that in your memory bank, in your being somewhere, to benefit you later on as well. But obviously in Yogananda's case, it's very different. And avatar coming back, you know, I keep forgetting this. Priyank said it's not reincarnated. It is, what's the word? We don't have Priyank here to remind us when it's an avatar coming back.
We did not absorb his words, did we? In the fullness of our consciousness.
must learn.
Must learn better. But yeah, it then goes on to say in the chapter how this then went on to affect him. And he says that, so him as a young boy, he was chatting with Dwarka. So this is the son that went to tell his brother of his plans. And I'm going to quote the book because it's beautiful. He says, I felt a love for God descending with avalanche-like force. Just imagine in that moment, that feeling, avalanche-like force. You know, it's that descending of love, but it's also an ascension as well. You know, loving is both giving and receiving. It's one. And that must have been so profound to feel in that moment. And I thought it might be nice for us to read some of Yogananda's writings on on God and what that meant for him and how he expressed God in his own words. So Chris, would you like to start us off?
Yes.
While he desperately tries to find it.
In the Mukunda's plan.
No, Mukunda,
I'll read it. It's please. Shall I read it, Chris?
Would that be okay? Go for it.
Yeah. So it says, God is eternal bliss. His being is love, wisdom, and joy. He is both impersonal and personal and manifests himself in whatever way he pleases. He appears before his saints in the form each of them holds dear. A Christian sees Christ, a Hindu beholds Krishna or the Divine Mother, and so on.
Devotees whose worship takes an impersonal turn become conscious of the Lord as an infinite light or as the wondrous sound of Om, the primal word, the Holy Ghost. The highest experience man can have is to feel that bliss in which every other aspect of divinity, love, wisdom, immortality, is fully contained.
Wow. And you could tell how powerful these words are because we've all just needed a little moment there of silence. I mean, you could meditate on those words, couldn't you, for a long time, mm-hmm. and to truly try to realize what that actually means, Mike.
And when Guruji talks to Dwarka and he gets those kind of feelings, he feels like God very strongly. If that would happen to me, I would maybe take that as a sign that I need to go to the Himalayas and go find God. And that's kind of how he interprets it as well, and why he goes. So I totally understand why this is happening.
Yeah, and exactly, like he does do that, it says. And then that afternoon, he fled. He went to the Himalayas, off he went. You would, after you've experienced that kind of a realization, a union, whatever you wish to call it, you would flee to the Himalayas, wouldn't you? And he did. And unfortunately, or fortunately, actually, depending on how you want to look at it, his brother caught him. He chased him and he was forced to return home, as is often the story with Yogananda trying to go to the Himalayas, not to be in this lifetime, or his lifetime, I should say. And he was just permitted his pilgrimage to the Shioli tree, as we talked about in the last episode. But it's interesting to me that as a young boy, Yogananda felt that, you know, the Divine Mother, God, was in the Himalayan mountains. So often we are taught that, you know, it's portable paradise within our own beings, and it's attainable or able to be in communion with at all times, no matter if you're in the mountains or in your home or at work. But I suppose that it's very relatable, isn't it? I don't know about any of you guys, but, you know, when I first, you know, came more into spirituality, I did have these, and sometimes I still do, these inclinations to, you know, go and run off into the woods and be still and you know, just be. And, you know, I think that's what he was feeling in that moment, which is really lovely.
I'm so glad that Yogananda doesn't advocate for going into a Himalayan cave or going into the mountains, because I don't think that would be for me. I would go like, yep, I quite like a warm shower, and I quite like, you know, being indoors at night. And but I do understand that some people totally feel that this is like the easiest way to go, to just go away. And honestly, this is not just something, I mean, in India, when you grow up, you probably hear the stories of the yogas of the Himalayas, but I see that often in all kinds of cultures, that people just want to be away from society. You know, here in California, it's often people who live in the desert, but also in Europe, you often see that people who just live in the woods by themselves and have a simple life. And And I'm fascinated by when I see like a clip on or a documentary on someone who lives totally by themselves and they're happy. They're like it's not like that they're there because they feel like they have to, but that they want to. They just want to be away from it all. And I guess when you're a yogi and your goal is to reach God inside you, you don't need other people, right? So I guess it kind of makes sense.
Mm, yeah, for sure. I also remember I watched this TV program, nothing to do with Yogananda, but it was people who had, you know, built homes in the wilderness and in the wild. And this one man, he had basically gone into what I would call my dream in the outward world. You know, he'd gone into the forest, he'd made himself a home, you know, all of this. But he said that, you know, he really wanted to escape the world. And what he realized is that when he got there and he had escaped the world, it hadn't escaped him, because his problems, his things that he was facing internally, went with him. And there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there? Like, I know in my own life, in the times where I feel that I would love to run away into the woodlands, it's actually a time where there's perhaps a little discord, and really it's just asking to go within. That's just my experience. Obviously, I cannot speak for anyone who does live in the Himalayan caves or the mountains. I'm sure it's wonderful. Chris, what do you think?
I can only think what Yogananda teaches me, you know. Really try to keep going back to that. And there's a story that he teaches in the lessons, and essentially I'll ask a question, and would you rather be in hell with one good person or an angel by your side, or would you rather be in heaven surrounded by little devils? And you know, it's a story that, you know, it's much more detailed, but essentially then that is heaven within yourself. You know, you bring that with you no matter where you go, and then you manifest that no matter where you are. That may be the parable of that story. I think it might be something different, but it just popped into my mind where I think it's very true that what you said, that, you know, if you have problems, they're not just going to go away because you run to the Himalayan mountains. But Yogananda had a mission to do. You know, he had a journey that Lihir and Mahasaya talked about, and that we're going to see in the next part of this chapter. And that was something that was already ordained, it seems. And there is some truth to that. So it does surprise me in some way that, you know, he was drawn there. But we do know that he had such a relationship with the great gurus, you know, the yogis in the Himalayan mountains, that maybe he was one himself there. So he was potentially just drawn to that life, to live that life again, because he had such a blissful, you know, deep-seated memory in his superconsciousness. But yeah, it's something we could all run away from problems, but they'll eventually find you if you run away from them.
Mm. I definitely feel like with Yogananda, it was not a running away. It was more running toward his soul calling. But he was teased mercilessly, wasn't he, by his brother for wanting this. And there's a story in Mejda, which Mike and Priyank both brought to the table. So as it's been duly noted, literally, I feel like we should just summarize it a bit, but it does reflect what happened. Mike, would you like to tell our lovely listeners and watchers what's recounted in Mejda about this and what happens afterwards, importantly?
Well, it is kind of, we mentioned some of it already. So he met Dwarka Prasad, and he told him about the yogis in the Himalayas. And so Guruji, he goes, okay, I want to go. And at first he reveals his plan to Dwarka Prasad, and Dwarka Prasad tells him, don't go. And he also reveals his plan to Ananta. But then on a second attempt, he actually goes, and they live in Bareilly at the time, and Bareilly is actually quite close to the Himalayas. So it's a I guess it's a good place to kind of go. And then he goes, but unfortunately he doesn't get very far. And Ananta kind of expects him to go. He kind of knows that this is going to happen, and he even before he gets very far, I think Yogananda is going on foot at this point as well. So he just goes and says, "Mukunda, where are you going?" and brings him back. And Guruji is back meditating under the Shioli tree at the end of the story.
Mm, yeah. And then it also goes on to say how afterwards his brother kept a really close eye on him. And he'd taunt him mercilessly. And but it said, and I'd love to read this line, it says, "But their jibes only fanned the smoldering embers of Mejda's desire to seek God in the solitudes of the Himalayas." Wow. And I'd love for ourselves and also any of our listeners and watchers out there to have a little introspect on how, going back to the question I asked before, you know, how often are we inspired by the resistance that we face on the path, and how often do we succumb? And I feel like this is a real living example of what can be achieved when you allow it to inspire you along the way. And we're obviously very glad that it did. Otherwise, we would not be sitting here. We would not be talking on this podcast, and our lives would not be changed. But yeah, that little section ends quite... my heart goes out in that little section, because he goes on to say that this is in the autobiography now, he says that, you know, his heart wept for his mother who had passed, but also his divine mother, who he felt he could no longer be with either. It's a, yeah, you kind of want to give him a little hug in that moment. Poor little Mukunda. And then it goes on to reveal what life was like for the family after his mother passes. And I think, you know, it's actually quite a valuable insight, because it's quite a big event, isn't it? It was unexpected. And it really did have quite an impact on each family member, I can imagine. And he says that the rent left in the family fabric was irreparable. I mean, that's quite a statement, isn't it? You know, it could not be repaired. It was such a large tear. But then he goes on to tell us that it seems that his father actually changed, and he became, you know, more loving, more nurturing, more approachable and tender, which is, again, it's that his father even took the inspiration of that experience of suffering and of hardship and allowed himself to be changed by that experience into something else that embodied the two.
That's a very interesting point. When I read that, I thought often how aware some parents are of the role that they actually play in the raising children. Because I feel like in this case, Guruji's parents, they were very aware. They were very much that you be this kind of person and I'll be that kind of person. Maybe that comes naturally, but definitely when Guruji's mother passed away, Guruji's father, Bhagavati, he felt the need to change his role. He said, "I can be the strict authoritarian if there is a loving mother at the house, but if there isn't, then I have to be both." And he clearly saw that he's playing a certain role and that he now needs to play both roles. And that requires a certain level of self-awareness, which I find great respect for, that he actually has that.
It actually reminds me of a song or chant that Yogananda has, the Wick, Saint Wick, like, you know, you didn't meditate, you didn't concentrate, you know, wake, yeah, you know, wake, wake, sit, wake. And it's such a great, powerful tool that whenever you are slipping, your concentration slipping, you know, this is really like a Yogananda's way of almost disciplining, helping you discipline your mind. And why I say this is that it's grit through necessity, what we can do, you know, out of necessity, like we can change, you know, when it really comes to it, Yogananda's urging us to wake up, you know, hey, you know, time's ticking, you know, you're not gonna go through your entire life, you know, wasting this time. You have to act now, you have to change now. And so Bhagavati here is forced into changing. You know, it's out of necessity that he changes, and it's such a powerful tool, and it kind of makes me think about the idea of suffering and the idea of, you know, this perception of evil, you know, this idea of good and bad, and then really why God permits evil. And then I was thinking, yes, well, there's a book on that, isn't there? And I did jump into that book, and maybe the listeners know of it, but if you don't, Why God Permits Evil and How to Rise Above It is the title. And maybe I can segue into maybe reading this, because there's a couple bits in there that Yogananda very kindly gives us the answer to this great question of why God permits evil. And I was going to give this classic hospital pass to one of you guys to say, why does God permit evil? And see what you think. But let's, you know, let's not suffer any more than what we need to. And maybe God, maybe Yogananda can give us the answer. But Mike, do you want to kick us off?
Good and evil must ever be complements on this earth. Everything created must bear some guise of imperfection. How else could God, the sole perfection, fragment his one consciousness into forms of creation distinguishable for himself? There can be no images of light without contrasting shadows. Unless evil had been created, man would not know the opposite, good.
Night brings out the bright contrast of day. Sorrow teaches us the desirability of joy. Though evil must come, woe to him by whom it comes. He who is enticed by delusion to play the villain's part must suffer the villain's sad karmic fate, while the hero receives the hallowed reward of his virtue. Knowing this truth, we must shun evil. Becoming good, we ultimately rise to God's high estate, beyond both evil and good.
So that's page 6. That's at the very beginning of the little booklet, the little book of Why God Permits Evil. And it does go on later in page 33. And there's a beautiful poem that I want to read out. And the prelude to this is to say that no man, no prophet will ever be able to wipe away all the inequalities and divisions on this earth. But when you will find yourself in the consciousness of God, these differences will vanish and you will say, oh, life is sweet and death a dream when thy song flows through me. Then joy is sweet and sorrow a dream when thy song flows through me. Then health is sweet and sickness a dream when thy song flows through me. Then praise is sweet and blame a dream when thy song flows through me. And I just thought that was such a great part of God Permits Evil. Why God Permits Evil, sorry. And looking at all the suffering that poor Mukunda is going through at such a young age, and seeing the change in his father, and you know how this brings about goodness in his father, would have been such a great role model at the time for him as well. Yeah, Mike.
And it kind of tells us that the darkness has to be there, because otherwise people would not look for God in the world, right? Otherwise we would be very happy and never notice that we should be actually trying to get out of this world. Mm-hmm. And I think it has this effect in Guruji's life. So it is a very traumatic and sad experience as a mother passes away. But from that moment onward, his vigor to look for God or yogis in the Himalayas or some manifestation of it in his life becomes like multiplies, and he's really making a strong effort to find something, to some solace, because he feels the only thing that can give him solace is God.
I feel like it's a real opportunity when we're presented with these challenges in life to either go closer to God or further away. And that's ultimately a choice, isn't it? But I do find personally that in the midst of trials, I find myself deepening in my spiritual practices and in how I try and navigate this life experience, however easy or difficult. But I do love what he says there, in that you then go beyond both good and evil, and you know that that duality exists no more, which is a very freeing concept. And it's like you say, you know, when you realize that you are suffering in your human experience, you do ultimately want to free the soul, right? And lose this human life that we have been living through. So Yogananda was definitely suffering in that time with his mother passing. Yeah, Chris.
You know what struck me going around Italy? I was there for a few months and going in and out of temples and doing all the touristy bits and checking out all the beautiful paintings that they have from the, gosh, like 500-year-old paintings. And there was a lot of suffering 500 years ago. And there was a lot of, you know, pain and a lot of wrongdoing. And you can see it in the artwork. You know, it's very typical to see a monk of sorts, you know, looking up to the sky, you know, praying for God to answer their prayers. And this was really, I could see it in the artwork a lot, you know, this idea of suffering and looking to God, turning to God. And that was the pinnacle. That was really the ideal, let's say, you know, in the time where suffering was widespread, which there's suffering today, but not in its completeness as it was maybe 500 years ago in many places. So yeah, it's a legacy, and you can really still see it there for us to reflect on.
And on top of that, in medieval times, like, there was a lot of suffering, lives were much shorter, and the living standards were very low. And Guruji also said that Kriya Yoga had been forgotten for this whole, most of this age. So there was not really a way, like, even if you loved God, you could, I think that's kind of why our world religions are the way they are right now, because they came out of the Kali Yuga, and that was the way to worship God in that time. You were practicing Japa Yoga, you were like repeating the name of the Lord over and over again, and
yeah. Or prostrating.
I'm not sure how helpful that was. Yeah,
but it's like directly whipping yourself to try to bring you closer to God.
But what a great example, though, set by his father, that he would, because it says in the book that his father would then, you know, retire like a little hermit and go into his room and practice his kriyas. What an example that your parental figure is going through a lot of suffering, has or is transforming himself and becoming both mother and father at the same time. And you're seeing that transformation in front of your eyes. And also, he is deepening his own spiritual practices. And that probably set such a great tone for Yogananda as he continued throughout his life and had many trials along the way and triumphs. I think it was probably a very useful way for Yogananda to experience that.
The language that Yogananda uses is very, very powerful, and no doubt he had such depths of feelings of sorrow in these moments. And it makes me think that, you know, somebody like Yogananda, and maybe the form of being human, is that it is limitless, isn't it? You know, upward and downward, this experience that we can have. We can experience excruciating pain, even if it's psychological, or especially if it's psychological, and then extreme bliss, you know, divine, godlike bliss. And Yogananda kind of, he emulates that for me in a way. Whenever we're reading this, I feel like I'm going through it with him. You know, we did the last part and the first part of this chapter, and I really felt it. And he feels so deeply, but yet in his own words, sorrow teaches us the desirability of joy. And so in the depths of this sorrow, he can kind of flip that on his head and go the opposite end, and he can feel this extreme joy and bliss. And it's quite incredible, but that, you know, the spectrum of being human is infinite, really, in some ways, isn't it?
It's very inspiring, isn't it? There's such a massive lesson in there for us all to take on in our own life. But it's also curious and kind of sweet to me that as Mukunda, as a little boy, he saw his father and he saw all of this wonderful things happening, but he still wanted to help in some way. And so he goes on to say how he attempted to get an English nurse for his father to make, you know, life more comfortable. And just before we go on to talk about how his father responded to such a question, something that struck me is that the words Yogananda uses here, he says, so I attempted to engage an English nurse to attend to details that would make my parents' life more comfortable. But parents is plural. So what do you think he meant with that?
An excellent question. I have, for me, English is my second language. And I felt like this is one of those sentences where you need to read between the lines. And I feel like this could mean a lot of different things. It could be that he would, I'm not sure, was Bhagavati ill or something that he would need a nurse in his life, or was he actually looking to present his father with a new partner? So I really don't know exactly what this means. What do you guys think?
Yeah, not to be the bearer of simple news in some way, but the apostrophe is before the S, which would mean that the life belongs to the parent. So it's actually, I think, just referring to one parent.
And this is why we have English. Yes, because I have to say, when I read it, I always thought that he just meant his father. And then when I was reading it again, I thought, oh, hang on, is this plural? But there you go.
I think it's just his father in this case. But it would have been, you know, looking back on the life that he was used to, was that his mother really kept the house. His mother dressed him, you know, to present him more formally than to the father when he returned. So we talked about the tradition that they would have had, being a relatively traditional household in that sense. And so his mother would have done a lot around the house that the father maybe wouldn't have gotten involved in. So Yogananda probably saw that and said, hey, there's a gap there. Why don't we fill it? But I think it was Priyank that said it was one of the most romantic lines in the whole book. What was to come next?
What's to come? And I have to agree. I really do. His father replies, service to me ended with your mother. And I love that wording. Service to me. It's not that he wanted to withdraw his service to another, it's that actually he didn't want anyone to be of service to him anymore, because that ended with his sole love, which was his mother. So romantic. It's really beautiful. And again, it's like another lesson in having that spiritual soul union with another. And actually, I'd like to talk about this. Actually, Chris, you go. You can say.
Yeah, it's lovely in many, many ways. It is, I think Priyank is quite right. It's one of the more, if not the most romantic line in the autobiography of a yogi. And it just shows that he clearly valued the service that, you know, that role that his mother did play. And it wasn't that the service itself could simply be replaced, because in theory, you know, you could replace the tasks and, you know, write them all down. Okay, well, you know, this is everything that the mother did, and I'm sure they could be replaced, but it's with the love and the devotion that the mother, you know, from what we've read, would have given into the service, and the bond that the two of them would have had together, and the love that they would have shared together was irreplaceable. And it was that really stands out to me, that, you know, that was the irreplaceable thing. Very, very beautiful.
Mm, yeah. And it really was a spiritual marriage, wasn't it, from the get-go. And I was researching about this, actually, because not being married, I wouldn't really know what a spiritual marriage is like. So I thought it'd be interesting to research it. And I came across a little explanation that I thought was quite nice. So I'm gonna read it out, and we'll see what you two feel about it. It says, marriage means unity on the physical, mental, and spiritual planes. An ideal human marriage is the communion of two souls. Marriage is for the purpose of each partner helping to uplift the other in a commitment of divine friendship, love, and loyalty that will move both souls closer to their true nature in the incarnation they share. And it further provides the medium and right environment to invite other souls seeking rebirth on earth to come into the circle of their expanding love. So for me, it feels like, you know, two souls towards one goal, and in union with that. What do you feel, Chris?
Yeah, I'm married, and I talk to my wife with what the teachings that Yogananda has, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think I was very, very blessed that I dug deep in the moment of suffering, and I received an answer when I wasn't with my wife, that yes, it was going to be someone to come to follow. And, you know, that would be, because I was asking, you know, for a partner, in the sense I asked for that. And so there's a real moment that I felt I received a calmness in a response and answer. And when I met my wife, we met on a train, and we, like, immediately, it was like recognizing somebody from a past life, you know, recognizing. And funny enough, actually, when I went back that night, we went on a date, and I actually showed my now wife the lesson I was reading at the time. And on the in the lesson was the lesson about recognizing people from past lives. And it was on the day that we met. So there's moments like this where, you know, spirituality, you know, is hand in hand, like, you know, this divine relationship that we all have together, I consider it divine as well. So, you know, divine spirituality, you know, it is what you put into it as well. And you could build that over lifetimes and, you know, really cash in on that, as we should do, and build on it lifetime over lifetime. It's a very beautiful thing.
Guruji also talks about the importance of, he calls it divine love, as opposed to human love, that at some point in a relationship you kind of have to turn this human love into divine love, and it becomes universal love. And he also describes that one of the ways to do this is comparing it to friendship, or having friendship in a relationship. And he mentions that often, and I feel like this is probably one of the goals. I mentioned this now because at Lake Shrine, brother has been giving talks about exactly this topic recently, which have been very popular.
Yeah, what was I gonna say? Yes, Chris.
Yeah, I just on this topic, you know, we could spend a whole episode, you know, talking about this. Is such a deep topic, but it does make me think, you know, this devotion that we have to one another, and you know, Bhagavati talking about his wife, like, you know, he's not going to accept any ministrations from any other woman. And that relationship, it was a divine spiritual relationship that the two of them had, and it's a very beautiful, immeasurably valuable thing. And I thought, okay, well, maybe they shared lives together in the past, and they came together, you know, as souls to achieve this great, you know, handover of bringing up Mukunda, you know, given this avatar a home. So no doubt they were highly advanced souls themselves, but I thought, how many times have our lives crossed paths? You know, our lives, even, you know, today, that we're talking, who knows, we may have shared lives in the past as brothers or sisters, aunts or uncles, cousins, or, you know, friends, siblings, who knows. And I thought that there was a quote here from Yogananda that I'd read it if that's okay. And it's on the topic of reincarnation. And he said, by reincarnation, the soul travels through the forms of mineral, plant, animal, and human life. In different incarnations, the soul is encased in bodies of the brown, white, black, yellow, and red races, that man may learn non-attachment to any particular body and race. Finally, he realizes his true nature of spirit. He knows himself as a child of God, present in everything.
Wow.
Yeah. My Lord. And wow. And I don't want to go too deeply into this, but it was always a question to my mind, you know, that this soul being incarnated now in a human form, you know, did it go through the animal kingdom? Did it go through the plant kingdom? And here's Yogananda telling us, yeah, you know, mineral, plant, animal, human form. It's pretty exceptional, isn't it? The journey that we've been on.
Definitely. And then to find yourself in union with another soul who is also aligned is quite amazing, isn't it? And if any of our listeners are interested more on this topic, because we definitely could talk about this for hours, Chris, Mike and Priyank did a lovely, lovely episode on spiritual marriage in the Awake series, minute 47. I listened to it again yesterday. It's a lovely episode. So please, if you do want to delve more into it, do listen to that, because it's really lovely. And there's lots in there to digest upon. So yes, with this chapter, he said no to that, having another union with another, and that was that. And that is how that part of that chapter actually concludes. But we do have some photographs on the right hand page. I do love a photograph. It helps me feel really connected, I think, especially as like a new reader with, you know, perhaps fresh eyes, or one that's not even on the path, or, you know, has engaged in that yet. It makes it more real. And for anyone that cannot view the physical copy of the book or even a digital one, you have a picture of Yogananda Ji in his high school youth with his elder brother, Ananta, which is lovely. And then next to that picture, you have Yogananda later on in Calcutta in 1935 with his eldest sister, Roma, and his younger sister, Nalini, which is also interesting to me that he went back. And I'd love to know if the story in 1935, when he met his sisters again, if anyone knows of the tale. I'm sure Priyank would know. I should have asked him prior to this. And then also at the bottom, we have his elder sister, Uma, as a young girl. So yeah, very, very lovely to have those images. Chris.
I'm trying to emulate Yogananda's long flowing hair, but I've got long hair. It's almost
oh wow, yeah, you do.
What, do the readers think Yogananda would have a man bun if he was a
man? True. Although man, I have to say, Chris, so. It's not a patch on how long my hair is. I don't know if you've ever seen how long my hair is, both of you, but it goes all the way.
Wow.
It is all the way down to the thighs.
Wow. That's very impressive. Very impressive. That's a lot of commitment and patience, having hair almost down to my shoulders. But Yogananda, you know, looks incredibly different there.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a topic that is interesting for me, is the ability to change the physical appearance and what yoga, practice of yoga might actually do to your physical appearance. But of course, he was younger there. So, you know, naturally you're going to age and change. But it is, that's his brother, yeah, in the top left.
Yes, his elder brother.
The Ananta, the famous Ananta. Looks very much like his father, no?
In the
other picture. His jawline and his maybe a bit more sternness in the face. He looks very much like his father, Bhagavati. Mm. Yeah, I also enjoying the pictures throughout the book. I do enjoy the picture, and I'm beginning to bring it even more to life.
His brother Ananta looks kind of exactly like I imagined him. he's like this kind of very, very earnest kind of person. I don't want any bad words. But he seems like a kind of a leader kind of person with authority. That's how I see him there. It's great to see his sisters as well in the other picture, that they're both still there in 1935. When I think his sister Roma and his sister Nalini, they both have each like a chapter about them later on. One of them about her husband and the other one about her gaining weight and having children and everything. So they play a big role. And then Uma is the one who challenges him. We already went through that, right? With the balloons and
And the boil, the infamous
and
boil.
The boil. Yes. Necromancer story, yeah,
indeed, yeah. Which we did delve into. So if you did miss that episode, do go back and listen to it, because it's quite an interesting one. But yeah, I love the pictures. I'd love to know what our audience also feels about the pictures in various points of the book, if you find them, how you feel about them really, and all your thoughts on this episode as well, and all the topics we've discussed. You know, like we always say, we are here to be of service to you. That's really why we're here. So we don't just love the sound of our own voices. So do let us know what you feel about this section of the chapter. And we've got a very, very different turn in the next part of the chapter, don't we, Mike? If you would like to just give us a really brief little tidbit of what can be expected to come in the next part.
So for attentive readers, you'll probably notice that the name of the chapter was Mother's Death and the Mystical Amulet. And now we're turning more towards the mystical amulet that is given to his mother by a strange sadhu, and that will be passed on to Yogananda 1 year after mother's passing, even though there's a slight delay there, and we'll go into details of how the amulet materialized during his mother's meditation and why it was delayed a bit. So stay tuned for our next episode.
Be very interesting. I'm very excited actually to delve more into it, and I hope you all are too. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and for watching, and for both of you for this lovely space that we've held together. And homework. I think homework is to let us know what you felt about the chapter. That's your homework for all you lovely listeners and watchers. Stay tuned for another episode. Thank you so much. And we'll meet you all again soon. Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.